So far in this series, looking at the life of Elijah, we've looked at how things went from bad to worse, with the kings of Israel getting steadily worse in terms of their sin. And then we saw how Elijah arrived on the scene, and throughout that long drought was supported by God, both in practical ways, but also in terms of preparing him for what was to come. And tonight, we move forward, and we look at this key incident, an incident which Arthur Zanoni, an American academic, describes as one of the most dramatic accounts in the Bible. One can imagine how people would have loved to tell it around campfires. And I'm sure that Arthur Zanoni is right about that, that in the days and years afterwards, this story would have been told many times. But I think we need to tread carefully as we look at this story, in case we get distracted by some of the amazing things that happen in it, and maybe miss what's going on beneath the surface. It's easy to remember the miracles, but we need to recognize and respond to what God is saying to us. The Jewish philosopher Martin Buber talked about miracles, such as the one in tonight's passage, and he described them as having abiding astonishment. There's two parts to that that I just briefly want to tease out. They're abiding in the way that Zanoni said, told around campfires, but also in the way that Psalm 145 says, where we read, "One generation commends your works to another. They tell of your mighty acts. They speak of the glorious splendor of your majesty. And I will meditate on your wonderful works." These stories are exciting, and they're vivid, and they stick in our memories, which is a good thing, provided we go on and address the second part of Buber's phrase, the astonishment. How often do we stop and wonder at what God has done for us? And the wonder, yes, it's the wonder of God's power, but we shouldn't be astonished that God can do these things. Maybe we should be astonished that he chooses to do these things and chooses to do them for us again and again and again. And we need to remember that God acts consistently towards us. And in doing so, we also have to acknowledge our own frailty. And so tonight, as we look at this story, I'm not going to be focusing too much on the miracle or even too much on the power of God. What I want us to consider tonight is the importance of making a decision to stand with God and to live accordingly, as consistently as we possibly can. Arthur Zanoni goes on to note that not only are these narratives highly attractive and unique in their own right, but they open upon a vista, upon a variety of important literary, historical, and theological problems. And the key problem that we find in 1 Kings tonight is a very straightforward question. It's the question, who is God here? So we see a showdown between Yahweh and Baal. But when that question has been resolved, another one follows on. Elijah has made his position clear. He's declared his stand. He stands with God. But the question remains, who else will join him? And that's our challenge for this evening as well. And I want to dig into this chapter by looking at what I've called seven calls and responses that we find in it. And first of all, we get the call from God to Elijah. God tells him to go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. After 3 years of drought, God tells Elijah to go. And Elijah responds, stepping into danger by going to present himself to Ahab. So this call is met by immediate and unquestioning obedience from Elijah. And the second call that we want to look at was only briefly touched on, because we shortened the readings a bit tonight rather than read the whole chapter. And this is when Elijah meets Obadiah. Obadiah was Ahab's top civil servant. And just in case you're puzzled, he is not the Obadiah who has a book named after him in the Old Testament. But this Obadiah, although he worked for Ahab, had hidden 100 of Yahweh's prophets in a cave and provided them with food. Elijah called on Obadiah to announce his presence to Ahab. And initially, Obadiah was more than a wee bit hesitant about that. But in time, he agreed to do it. And I wanted to highlight Obadiah's call and response tonight, because I think he serves to remind us that we can follow God in different ways. Obadiah wasn't the star attraction, but he played a role behind the scenes. Maybe not glamorous, but still important, especially if you were one of those 100 prophets that he was providing security and food for. So we can all serve in different ways as God calls us to. And the third call happens when Elijah does meet Ahab. You may have noticed in the reading that they have a wee exchange of pleasantries and swap name calling. But eventually, Elijah calls on Ahab to gather the people and the prophets of Baal and to meet with him on Mount Carmel. And surprisingly, perhaps, Ahab agrees to do what Elijah says. Now, we're not told why he agrees, but one of the things that I wonder about is how confident Ahab was, overconfident in himself. You see, Mount Carmel had become one of the centers of Baal worship, so it was very much like he was on home territory, and perhaps he was overconfident. We know the outcome, we don't know the motive. And the fourth call happens as we move to that scene on Mount Carmel. And before any of the dramatic events of that day, Elijah calls to the people of Israel. We read in verse 21 that he said, "How long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal is God, follow him." And the Israelites respond with a resounding silence. This idea of wavering between two opinions, the Hebrew word apparently can mean to limp or to hop. And one of the images that's used to describe this is like a wee bird that hops back and forth between two branches because it can't decide where it wants to settle. And that's the idea behind what Israel are doing here. Arthur Zanoni says that they wanted to keep one foot in the traditional faith of ancient Israel and the other foot in the worship of Baal. But I think there's a bit more to it than that, and I like the way that Walter Brueggemann captures this when he says that to choose against Yahweh in Israel is impossible, but to choose singularly for Yahweh appears to be excessively radical and costly. The issue is endlessly a life or death issue for Israel. And I think this is the key issue in tonight's passage. It's not the first time that the people of Israel have been faced with a choice. Remember that Joshua presented them with a similar choice before they entered the land of Canaan, when he said to them, "Then choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, but as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." Well, in that case, the people were insistent that they would choose to follow Yahweh, but they weren't consistent in doing it, because that following didn't last very long. And of course, this idea of wavering is not limited to ancient Israel. If we think about the letter to the church in Laodicea, then we read in Revelation chapter 3, "Because you are lukewarm, neither hot nor cold, I am about to spit you out of my mouth." To be lukewarm, wavering between options, not fully committed. Our choice, like Israel's choice, is to follow God and follow God alone. And that means abandoning all other gods. Dale Ralph Davis says that this is no mere academic question. Elijah's formulation assumes that theology leads to discipleship. Commitments have consequences. And Jesus said something that follows along these lines in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 6, when he said, "No one can serve two masters. Either you'll hate the one and love the other, or you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." The people of Israel were wavering. I wonder how much we waver between our commitment to God and our attraction to other things. I'm going back to Walter Brueggemann again. And he says, in a rather complicated thing, so I'll leave this up for a wee while, "The settlement of both and, both faith and consumerism, both faith and capitalism, both faith and militarism, both faith and racism, etc., etc., is most often not a deliberate decision, but rather a slow erosion of awareness." Now, I'll let you add in your own "and" to that sentence, both faith and whatever it might be for you. But I want to focus in on this idea of a slow erosion of awareness, because I think that's what happened in ancient Israel. They didn't decide to follow Baal overnight. When they entered the land of Canaan, this thinking, this following two gods, crept into their lives as they occupied more and more of the land and gradually associated with the people living there. Worship of Baal didn't arise with Jezebel, although she did put a lot of energy into promoting it. And I think that, like the people in Elijah's Israel, in order to guard against that slow erosion of awareness, we have to make a choice. We have to choose to love the Lord our God with all our heart, with all our soul, and with all our mind. That's the essence of discipleship, which is one of the core themes that we're looking at this year in this church. And it's a huge challenge, and it's a lifelong challenge. But as we'll see, it's a challenge that's worth following through on. Going back to our text, the fifth call and response is when the prophets of Baal call out to their God. And they put on a real show for Baal, dancing and swaying and whipping themselves into a frenzy of self-mutilation. And Elijah can't help but goad them when nothing happens. Patricia Berlin, who's a Jewish writer, said, "His taunt was that the reliance on any god or gods who can be preoccupied or absent or dormant or dependent on the antics of the clergy." Well, despite all of their calling to Baal, there is no response. He is preoccupied, absent, dormant, unresponsive, silent, and impotent. And after that, it's Elijah's turn. But before he calls out to Yahweh, Elijah does a few interesting things. He starts by repairing the altar that's there already, an altar to Yahweh that must have been there before Mount Carmel became a center for Baal worship. And he uses 12 stones to build the altar, deliberately, I think, reminding the people of their past and all that Yahweh has done for them. Also reminding them that he's a God of all Israelites in both the northern and southern kingdom. And then Elijah gets 12 jars of water poured over the altar until it fills the trench around it. And I think this demonstration, pouring the water on, serves two purposes. Firstly, it makes the conditions as difficult as possible. Baal couldn't produce fire in ideal circumstances, in the middle of a three-year drought, when everything was tinder dry. Our God was about to demonstrate power beyond any shadow of a doubt by sending fire onto a sodden altar. But I think it also declares Elijah's confidence that Yahweh will triumph. Remember that they're in a drought that's lasted 3 years, and he's seen to be pouring 12 jars of water onto the altar. That's a lot of water to waste. But Elijah is certain of the outcome and is confident that the rain that God promised him when he sent him to Ahab will follow. And then Elijah calls to God in a very simple prayer. He asks that God let it be known today that you are God in Israel. A simple prayer with no religious palaver. And it sounds very much like the advice that Jesus gave to his disciples in Matthew chapter 6, where he said, "And when you pray, do not keep on babbling like pagans, for they think they will be heard because of their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him." God knew that the people in Elijah's Israel needed rain. And he demonstrates that through this episode on Mount Carmel. And in response to Elijah's simple, straightforward prayer, God sends fire. The altar is ignited. But there's a message in the fire that we need to pay attention to. Because in the Old Testament, it's symbolic of the active presence of God. Think about Moses at the burning bush, or the pillar of fire that led the Israelites after the Exodus. And this active presence of God stands in stark contrast to the absentee Baal. God can and does meet the needs of his people. And the second thing that happens as a result of this is that the people finally make a decision. And we see in verse 39, when all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Based on the fire sent to the altar, they're convinced. Who is God here? Yahweh, the Lord is God. And that seems like a good news story. But before we go on, we do need to address the issue briefly about the massacre of the prophets of Baal. Like many episodes in the Old Testament, This can seem violent, even harsh to us in 21st century Perth. Well, I think the Bible provides us with a clear explanation for that in the book of Deuteronomy, where we read in chapter 13, that prophet or dreamer must be put to death for inciting rebellion against the Lord your God. You must purge the evil from among you. God knew that the people of Israel could be easily swayed, so drastic action was needed in these circumstances. The prophets of Baal paid the price of their sin. And the spectacle on Mount Carmel is more or less over, but the story hasn't finished, and there is another call for us to consider. Because Elijah calls to God again in prayer. And Patricia Berlin, who I mentioned earlier, says that Elijah was still in anxious suspense until he was vindicated by a storm cloud blowing in over the Mediterranean. Indeed, he now displayed a nervousness he had never shown during the contest with the Baal men. Waiting for that rain was what really confirmed the promise that God had given to Elijah. And it's a victory that can be seen in a number of ways. Walter Brueggemann says that this is Yahweh the Creator, the maker of heaven and earth, the guarantor of fruitfulness, who now gives rain as a gift and a sign of sovereignty. In previous weeks, we've noted that Baal was supposed to be the rain god. Baal was supposed to be the fertility god, but he couldn't do anything to meet the people's needs. And the fire on Mount Carmel, well, that demonstrated God's power. But the arrival of the rain demonstrates God's graciousness. And yet, despite all of that, the contest for the soul of Israel is not over. As we'll find out in subsequent weeks, Ahab and especially Jezebel are still hostile. All of Israel's problems were not resolved in one day on Mount Carmel. So what about us? Well, like the ancient Israelites, we can't have a foot in both camps. So what does it take for us to stand with God? I suggest three things in closing. Firstly, we should live with abiding astonishment. We should wonder at all the things that God does for us. But like the ancient Israelites around their campfires, we should talk about that as well. We should never stop talking about how good God is to us. We also need to decide and commit. Treat it not like an academic question, but model and develop discipleship in all aspects of our lives. And finally, we should stand with God consistently and persistently. It's a huge lifelong challenge. It affects all aspects of our life, but it also offers a life-giving reward. So, if the Lord is God, follow him exclusively, singularly, and wholeheartedly. Amen.